Welcome to the Sorge Podcast, where we explore Sikh and wider South Asian history, art and philosophy with historians, artists and researchers.
Today I have the pleasure to talk to Priya Kaur, who is in her final year at the University of Birmingham studying policy, politics and economics. I came across Priya and her work on Twitter and thought it would be brilliant to discuss her dissertation in detail. The dissertation title is Understanding the Causes and Consequences of the 1984 Sikh Genocide in India. Before we dive into the dissertation, and as we do with all our guests, what we like to do is obviously, first of all, say thank you to you for making the time to record this and also for sharing your work. And then secondly, what we like to start with is just getting to know a little bit more about yourself. So your family background, how you ended up doing the degree you did and picking the topic for your dissertation. And yeah, I'll leave that to you.
Hi, firstly, I just want to say thank you for inviting me to do the podcast with you. So I'm Priya, and like you said, I'm in the final year at university. I'm from Wolverhampton and been raised in a Gursikh Amradhari family. I'm living with my grandparents and parents and siblings. So my grandparents are from Punjab originally, and they migrated over when they were like 16. So I've been brought up with Sikhi my whole life, with my family and extended family being very important. So these sorts of conversations have always been there. And then as I've got older, I've started to do my own research. I think a lot came from like Basics of Sikhi and the Rajwana TV YouTube channel. There was a lot on there, especially about 84, that got me interested in it and started making me do my own research. And then I think from coming to university, I think everyone starts to research more into their own history and ethnicity, religion a lot more. So that's definitely played a part in why I chose this topic. And then I think also, like, when I remember, I think it was like 2009 or something. And when it, yeah, 2009, when it was the 25 years remembrance rally in June. In June in London, I was going like for the first time with my family, and I hadn't heard about 84, like what happened before that. And like my family, my parents and my boys were telling me about like what happened. And like, it was really brief explanation because I think I was like 9 years old. And they literally just said how Darbar Sahib got attacked and Santaji was killed. And then in like months later in November, Indira Gandhi was killed, which led to the killings of November. And like through the conversations on that day with other people there, it sort of got like portrayed as a Sikh Hindu sort of conflict. And then like as I've got older and I've like had more conversations at home, done my own research, watched like different YouTube videos and different talks and stuff, it like I realized that it wasn't like that. And I think I knew I always wanted to do my dissertation on something to do with Sikhi, and then it just became apparent that it was going to be about 84, but I just wasn't sure like which angle I was going to take.
That sounds quite interesting. One question that I have just off the back of what you've been discussing is, during your own research and obviously the work that you've had to put in for this dissertation, was there anything that when in conversation with your family, it was almost new information to them? So was there any kind of moment where a relative was like, wow, I didn't know that?
Yeah, I think a lot of it was about the consequences afterwards. So the fact that when children were like going to school and stuff, the teachers would, that they'd have policemen come in to their classes to take the Sikh children, and the teachers would let them go, and they'd disappear after that. They wouldn't be seen. And then on their way home, this is after 1984, so like after November, they'd have to take different routes home every day, because there'd be people waiting for them to either get them to take them or to lead them to their families to take them. I don't think they knew much about what happened afterwards, rather than they knew more about like the actual, like the days of the killings, rather than the consequences afterwards as well.
Wow, that's actually very interesting. And we'll get into your research and your source base and how you found this out a little bit later on. But no, that's really interesting. Now, obviously, your title is Understanding the Causes and Consequences of the 1984 Sikh Genocide in India. Now, the first thing that caught my attention, and this is also because I did a module at university that was based just on genocide. And so my question to you is, how did you go about defining the term genocide and what do you mean by that term? So like, what is it distinctively you're discussing by a genocide? Because terminology means quite a lot. So obviously there's a difference between a brawl, a riot, a protest, a genocide, etc., etc. So how did you go about defining that and what do you mean by it in relation to your dissertation?
Yes, so I employed genocide rather than like riot or just simply violence, because I wanted to show from the beginning that it wasn't spontaneous and that it wasn't like a non-Sikhs versus Sikh, but it was like the state and the institution versus the Sikhs as a religious minority. In the introduction, I highlight the terminologies and the differences between riot and genocide definitions. So I defined riot as something as spontaneous and involving intergroup mass action without any sort of organization or state support, whereas genocides, on the other hand, are political crimes which have an organized nature and are executed within the bureaucratic institution. And through like my analysis, I show how it was the state who perpetrated this, and therefore it couldn't be defined as a riot. Because when you think of riots, like you think of what happened in 2011 here. And I just think when you look at what happened here and you look at what happened in 84, there's no way that you can compare the two. So I think that was like a big thing. I didn't want to use the word riot. And then originally I had it as violent, but I didn't want to use the word violence because it changes with violence, like the responsibility, where the responsibility lies can vary a lot. But with genocide, it's really clear where the responsibility lies and who is sort of at fault.
Okay, so just to kind of rerun through what you've discussed, I guess what you're trying to make completely accurate is that the responsibility lies with the state. The violence is enacted upon a community. In this case, it's the Sikh community within India, and that it's whole scale destruction of that group then. Now, one question that I have is, if you didn't, it's not a problem, but it's just my curiosity has got the better of me, is did you refer much to the lawyer, what's his name, Raphael Lemkin, who came up with the term genocide in the 1940s? And if you did, how does his definition work in relation to what you're discussing?
No, I didn't use him. I used Alvarez's definition of genocide being a political crime.
Okay, interesting. The only reason I say that is because actually what you've just discussed in relation to your dissertation actually fits into what he says. And so I think his definition kind of comes down to a number of things. But I think Article 2 of the convention that he drew up, or was pivotal in drawing up, is basically, I think it says, genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, or racial or religious group. As such, killing members of the group is one. Causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group is the other. Deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. The next is then imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. And then the last one is forcibly transferring children of the group to another, or literally just destroying them, which is something that you've actually alluded to earlier on in relation to how children would be kidnapped from their schools and then murdered at the hands of the state. So yeah, it's just interesting to see how solid your work is and how it actually fits in with a lot of different definitions. Again, the only reason I come with this is because it's like it's stuck in my head from when I had to study this back in at university. Now, another question that came to mind is then, after all of the work that you've done and your concentration, I guess, on the fact that it's state-sanctioned, state-planned action that led to the genocide of the Sikhs during 1984 and onwards, what are your opinions then of the nation-state? Because surely the nation-state is flawed by its design, considering it can essentially get away with acts such as the decade and a half post kind of 1980s.
Yeah, I touch on that with identity, like with the feelings of identity and belonging. But I also look at the institution and the constitution to begin with, and shows how oppression is so is rooted within the institution. So like in Article 25 of the Indian Constitution, it specifically says how Sikhs are not recognized as Sikhs, but they're a sector of Hinduism, like the same with Jains and Buddhists. So I think that shows how it's already showing like disadvantage to religious minorities. It also already is like a majoritarian state. It favors majorities over religious minorities.
Yeah, and I guess the added implication is that there's no legal existence of that minority group in its own right. So that obviously has its own implications, which kind of brings us nicely to the next question, which is, you've spoken about obviously just now how Article 25 basically subsumes the identity of a Sikh Jain Buddhist into this overall arching idea of Hinduism. Now, why did you decide to start with partition and not look at history before this? Because, for instance, the role of the Akali Dal in the early 1900s, the role of the Singh Sabha movement, even the framework of religion, and how that kind of becomes part of the Sikh psyche thanks to the Singh Sabha and British Raj, etc. Wouldn't that have helped to inform the area of focus in your work? Or what was the reasoning then behind starting at partition rather than prior?
I think one point like is definitely like word limit. So there was only a certain amount that I could research if I wanted to go into detail. But then the other thing was because I used the concepts of like oppression, I found this idea of institutional oppression, and I wanted to, and by starting from the like formation of this new nation, I was able to look at the institutional oppression from like the very start. So I look at the process of independence, not just from 1947, it's like from 1928 when Nehru and Gandhi are making the promises of autonomy for Sikhs. They're making these assurances that they're gonna be looked after by the constitution. The constitution won't be passed without their approval. And then I look at how everything that they promised, they just went straight back on and said the circumstances have changed. And just how the fact that, like, there's a quote which I use in my dissertation where Gandhi says, if we go back on any of these promises that we've made of autonomy for Punjab and safeguarding of rights for Sikhs have every right to pull out their swords and fight back. And I think that was like a big thing, because I think if you ask people nowadays about Gandhi, they see him like he's like the international figure of peace, but a lot of people see him as like non-violent. So for someone who advocates for pacifism is saying like justifying and promoting allowing violence, it shows that, and then goes back on it, it shows the betrayal from the start. And I think that's what I wanted to show, that it wasn't just from like the 70s or the 80s, it started from when the nation started.
Fair. Would you say then that it was a purposeful plan on the behalf of people like Nehru and Gandhi and others who were instrumental in the formulation of this new nation? Was it pre-planned in that they were almost like they knew that they were going to renege on it? Or was that kind of a circumstantial change, whereas post-partition, post everything that had happened, events had led them to change their mind?
I think it was inevitable that it was going to happen. How it happened and when it happened, I think, was subject to change and just dependent upon what was happening at the time. But I think the outcome was inevitable. I think from the start, it's clear that that's how it was intent. That's how they intended it to go, and it was allowed to get to that point.
So they never intended to uphold the promises they made to the Sikhs in the first place.
Yeah.
Okay, but then what does that say then about Sikh leadership who were representing our community at that time? Obviously, Master Tara Singh is kind of synonymous with this movement, but what does all of this say then about Sikh leadership up until obviously Sanjay Nair Singh Ji?
Yeah, so I looked at like Master Tara Singh and Sant Fateh Singh with the Punjabi Sabha movement, and the downfall of Master Tara Singh led to the uprise of Sant Fateh Singh, but that was created through the through Nehru and Gandhi portraying a narrative that Master Tara Singh was asking for too much and he was too extreme. So I think it was more so how those in power were able to influence the Sikhs into thinking that the person that's actually protecting them is acting against them when it was the other way around.
It's interesting that you just mentioned that Nehru and Gandhi portrayed Master Tara Singh as a bit of a fundamentalist and kind of asking for too much, which is obviously a similar narrative to what Indira Gandhi does in the 80s with Sanjay Narasinghe. So yeah, it's just, I just found that comparison quite interesting. All right, no, fair enough. Now, just then moving into the key concepts that you're working with in your dissertation, why did you decide to focus on key terms being oppression, violence, and resistance in relation to the causes of the genocide?
I think because the terms are quite broad, especially oppression, like you have the aspect of the themes of power and control, which are major aspects, but, and then you get the institutional oppression, the ideas of, like said, control. And then with violence, I didn't want to just look at physical violence. There's aspects of mental violence, and it's called like violence on the soul, where it's psychological. And then with resistance, I think the idea of Santji and the resistance movement against the oppression was a key aspect in how the government portrayed why Operation Blue Star happened, was because of Santji. But I think using the concept of resistance, you're able to see what he did and why he did it.
So just to kind of elaborate and dig a little bit deeper into what you're saying, when you're discussing oppression, what examples are you providing?
So I look at oppression in terms, using a definition that defines it as four circles of control. So they say you first have your physical, then you have the economic control, then you have psychological control, then you have internalized control. And through those four circles of control, group is able to be oppressed. So you've got the physical control in terms of geography and physical control as in violence. And then you've got the economic control as in taking away economic power. So that's control. So in this case, it was how water control was taken away from Punjab, which meant that they weren't economically independent. And then you've got psychological control through things like the constitution, where they weren't even where their existence wasn't even noticed within the institution. They didn't exist. They were able to control them psychologically, which led to internalized control, which is where they self-sustain their own oppression. So the government don't need to do anything once they've got to that point and the oppression continues.
Okay, that's a fair enough theory, but in relation to the events that took place, how does that map out? So, like, providing an example from what you've studied, how does that theory apply?
So I go through from the Constitution to 1984, I go through how the government attained each control. So through like the Punjabi Reorganization Act, they reduced the size of Punjab.
But wasn't the Punjab Sabha movement actually kicks, like, as in the movement was from both sides, as in Punjab also wanted, like, as in a lot of Punjabis weren't against the Punjab Sabha movement. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, I don't disregard or disagree with what you're mentioning about the constitution and obviously the oppression that takes place. But for me, what I'm trying to pin down is, for most Sikhs living in the village, they don't even know, like, or wherever, they won't know about this constitution. They won't know that the constitution doesn't apply to, like, doesn't respect their existence as a separate identity until they have some type of, like, headbutting with the law or the government or some tentacle of its operation. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, how does that then become internalized? Because obviously a lot of people who may be listening to this will be like, well, theory makes sense, but how does that pan out in reality or in relation, sorry, to what unfolds? I obviously understand the actual violence of partition will have decimated Punjab and obviously, like, it's central to our history. And I can understand that violence becoming internalized, because then the narrative or the trouble that's triggered consistently after that is, well, if they were, like, any successionist demand, it's almost like if they were to become independent, look at partition. So, like, there's that kind of internalized violence, which I could see. But I just wanted to know any other example that you might have.
So I went from obviously the denying their existence from the constitution, and then to the Sikhs wanted a Punjabi speaking majority state so that they get the linguistic state benefit. But there were the Punjabi Sabha movement outcome wasn't how they wanted it to be. They didn't have the boundaries weren't redrawn how they initially requested them to be. Their control over waters, which symbolized like the was taken away from them, which I used showed how it like was sort of like a metaphor of how the government was able to control Punjab as a state. And then they were left out of, then they asked for the same constitutional status as Jammu and Kashmir, and they were left out of that as well. So I think the buildup of all these individual events led to the internalized control that I was alluding to.
Okay, so I guess what you're saying is when political requests are consistently denied, the balance of power is made clear, and that's what is internalized.
Yeah.
Okay, one question then that I have just off the back of that is, how do all of those political demands reflect or get absorbed by Sanjay Singh Ji? Because on the face of it, you could argue it's a completely political issue. It's completely down to the Punjab state government and the Delhi central government.
You know, your question, do you mean how did like Santji then, how did the government then use Santji as like an scapegoat?
Well, that's, I guess, a second question. And I guess you could answer this question off the back of it. But what I'm actually asking is, how do the events that you've spoken, obviously, I can understand how the Article 25 in the Indian Constitution relates to Sanjay Narayan Singh Ji. That is obviously quite clear. But in terms of the other stuff you've spoken about, so for argument's sake, the political request to for Punjab to be recognized the same way Jammu and Kashmir is, like, you could, on the face of it, you could argue that's a completely political issue. It's got nothing to do with Santaji, so to speak. But I guess what I'm asking you is, how does all of this connect? Like, how does Article 25, how does the events that led up to 1980, 1970 probably even, because obviously Nirankari massacre happens in 78 or 79, I think. How does all of that connect to Sanjay Narayan Singh Ji? Like, is it because, I don't know, Sanjay Narayan Singh Ji has become prominent enough within the Sikh community in Punjab that he is now a threat to the political establishment, or is perceived as a threat to the political establishment? Or is it that Sanjay Ji has taken up these political requests himself?
So I think that relates to the adoption of the Anand Prasad resolution and how Sanjay was like a big advocate for it. And obviously that's going against what the government wanted. So they didn't want to give the demands that were written in the Anand Prasad resolution, and Sanjay's influence on getting more Sikh, mobilizing the Sikhs into fighting for them. So the Kalidas' adoption of the Anand Prasad resolution was like simultaneous to the rise of Santaji's influence. And I think those two together, and Santaji's support of the Anand Prasad resolution and the demands within that, caused the government to then, because Santaji was such an influential figure, caused them to turn to him and use him as the scapegoat, to frame him as a terrorist, because he was fighting for the rights. I think if they wanted to single out one voice, it would have been his.
Okay, so what is it, or why was it that Sanjay Narayan Singh Ji was picked out to be the scapegoat against, or like, for argument's sake, because there are others like Santa Tarjan Singh Longwal, who gets assassinated after 1984. But why is it Sanjay Narayan Singh Ji? Is it because he is unwavering in his teaching of Sikhi? Because obviously there are like huge Amrit Sanchars, there are loads of people kind of abstaining from alcohol and tobacco and keeping kirs, etc. He's also advocating for villagers to arm themselves and protect themselves. Why is it that he's picked out? Is it because of what he's saying, or is it just because of the fact that he's an unwavering individual in the face of whatever the state throw at him? Or is it both?
Yeah, I think it's both. I think it's definitely to do with the fact that Santaji was not just like politically active. He was getting Sikhs into Sikhi. He was encouraging them to take Umrah. But also Sant Chi, in response to the government's speeches and their, what they were saying, Sant Chi was replying to them. So he actually outed the narrative of this Hindu Sikh conflict. He says, I've got the quote here. He says that she, Indira Gandhi's telling everyone that Bindrawale destroys temples and he doesn't like Hindu, he kills Hindus and he's responsible for all the temple destroying, but she's trying to create this Sikh Hindu conflict that isn't there. It's her who's creating it. And I think that, but he was like exposing the narrative that they've been trying to hide and they've been trying to push that isn't true. And I think the fact that he was so influential and he was like the easiest target, like the fact the name Operation Blue Star, like translated in Punjabi, is obviously Nila Tara, and like Santji where it was in blue, and no, like everyone saw him as like the star of the band at that time. So it was definitely a mix of the what he was saying, but also how he went about what he did.
Okay, no, that's quite interesting and fair comment, really. In then, obviously, what you've studied, and it's one of the main focuses of your dissertation, is what are then the key causes that lead to the violence that unfold? Are they all specifically targeting Sikhs, or is it that Sikhs are caught up in a wider range of non-Hindu, non-majoritarian sentiment?
So yeah, I found the cause and the like sort of motive to do with like control and power, and this idea that they wanted to increase their jurisdiction of control to not only just how people acted in the public sphere, but also in the private sphere, which meant controlling how they thought and controlling their actions. And it wasn't just Sikhs specifically. They were caught in this wider religious minority struggle within India. In the dissertation, I touch upon how between June 1984 and November, there was a instance where the government placed a Hindu nationalist flag on a masjid, and which instigated 10 days of lootings and an estimated, but obviously this figure, we don't know if it's true or not, 300 Muslim citizen deaths and thousands more injuries. So from this, I think it shows that it wasn't just Sikhs. It was part of this wider want to control every citizen within the nation to conform to how they think and their ideals. And but that's like with the consequences, how Hindus were also caught up in this as well. But yeah, in terms of the key motives, whether it was just targeting Sikh or a wider range of non-Hindu sentiment, June and November were obviously specifically against Sikhs, but it was part of this wider religious minority struggle that has been going on.
Would it be fair then to paraphrase and say that the birth of the nation state India led to a mechanism that worked in favor of the majoritarian community?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's put it.
Okay. And so the crux of the issue is actually the formation or the structure of the nation state. So it's actually the way it's been formulated, because obviously the part that you started with at the beginning is it all stems from the constitution and Article 25. If I remember correctly, I'm pretty sure the Sikh delegation never signed the constitution.
Yeah, no, they didn't.
Okay, which is in itself something that's quite interesting. But anyway, moving on. Now, the next question was actually, in your estimation, what were the government's motives in enacting state-sanctioned mass murder? But to be honest, I think we've literally just discussed that, and I think that's been dealt with. So moving then, obviously, is the logical next question is, what are the key consequences of the violence? Obviously, in terms of physical loss, a huge kind of swathe of individuals, including Sanjana Singh, are removed in a matter of days. Obviously, thousands of innocent people are also made shaheed in the process alongside those. And then there's obviously the trauma that goes with it, because obviously the trauma still runs deep, because otherwise we wouldn't be sat here discussing it, right? But obviously, in relation to your dissertation, what are the key consequences then?
So one of the key consequences I found is the theme of identity and belonging. So the Sikhs, and that's for Sikhs within India and abroad. So especially in the UK, I think the revelations of the UK's involvement in Operation Blue Star, and then what India as a state executed, this idea of where they belong, like their ethnicity, their nationality, like where do they belong, who do they identify with, I think was really broken, because their homeland, where all their history is, where their ancestors are from, they've executed these mass killings of their community, but then the country that they've been brought up in and raised in and they're currently living in also contributed. So I think this identity, this idea of where do I belong and who, what is my identity, has been a big consequence. And then also for the Sikhs in India, like 50,000 Sikh, around 50,000 were displaced. And I remember reading this quote of a young girl after 1984. She said, "I was made a refugee in my own homeland." And I think like the juxtaposition, oxymoronic nature of this quote really just gives and exemplifies this idea of they didn't have, their identity was lost and they didn't feel like they belonged anywhere.
The narrative that you've just told me doesn't sound any different to Sikh history in general. And what I mean by that is, like, the Galukaras that happen during the Misal period take place on, like, they take place in Punjab. I get it's not necessarily kind of the local government enacting this genocide, but that still takes place. The Mughals, even after the Mughals, you've got the Afghans, you've got this constant persecution. And you've, to be honest, you've got conflict in between all sorts of warring groups. And equally with the British, like, it's interesting that you've mentioned that there's a re-questioning of identity with the revelation that the SAS were involved in helping to plan Operation Blue Star. But like, the history of the British Empire is filthy. So like, I guess there's two questions in that, really. First one being devil's advocate is, what is unique about the violence that occurs in the 80s and respect other violence that has happened against the Sikh community in history? And then secondly, is it actually just the fact that there is a new framing around what's taking place, and there's a new player in the sense of a nation state? Because obviously nation states don't exist, like India doesn't exist as a nation prior to 1947. The British Raj exists and that all has it, all its own implications, etc. and whatever. But
I think a lot of it is to do with how recent it was, the fact that it was, how, because it was only in 84, it's been what, like 30 odd years, and it was so recent, and either parents or grandparents' generations would have lived through it. I think that's why it's such a bigger thing. It's not that this is worse or the violence committed now is like more emotional or anything. I think it's the fact of how recent it was.
So it's the lived experience aspect of it that is obviously more recent, I guess, and so obviously plays more of an impact, which is obviously valid. Yeah, no, I couldn't disagree with that. I think that's a superb answer, really, to that question. All right, so we've only got a handful of questions left. So one of them then is, obviously your dissertation focuses on the causes and what leads up to this state-controlled massacre, genocide, and obviously your research shows that it doesn't just take place just in 1984, it takes place over a number of years and in a number of different ways. Now, what do you feel you've added to the argument then, that the violence of 1984 was pre-planned state-sanctioned violence rather than some type of instantaneous match that just went off? And I guess something which is perhaps quite recent, which exemplifies what I'm talking about, is Pav Singh's book 1984, India's Guilty Secret, which does a really good job of showing how it isn't an instantaneous event, how people in all spheres of the government and at all levels were either deliberately not acting to ensure things would or would not happen. And then there were a lot of people who were deliberately acting to ensure the events that took place took place. So how do you view your work in relation to everything that is currently out there?
His book was incredible. I heavily referenced it throughout my dissertation. I think that what I added was because I used major theorists and concepts for the analysis, I was able to link things that perhaps didn't have direct link and then use that to illustrate the motives rather than just saying the facts of how who was involved and how they were involved. I was able to create non-direct links, and then this idea of institutional oppression from the beginning. I think that's how I added to the fact that it wasn't instantaneous and it had been pre-planned, and the pre-planned nature wasn't just the dates and stuff, it was the fact that this was going to happen regardless.
Okay, fair. Now, moving on then to your source base and the research that you did and the data that you used and everything else that went with it. So a couple of questions. How did you go about your research? What was your main source base? And was there anything interesting that came up in particular that you were wow?
So I use Google Scholar and different book and different papers. So Pavsing's book was definitely one of them. There's a journal article called Evolution of a Demand for a Sikh Homeland by S. Dillon, and that one was a really good one. And then another one by Sandhu, which was called The Sikh Failure on Partition of Punjab, and then Sant Janal Singh Bindrawali's Life, Mission and Martyrdom. Those were the papers that I referenced heavily and got a lot of the information from.
In relation to then kind of the government side of stuff and the side of things in terms of it being pre-planned and staged, etc., did you access government documents or white papers, or what was your source base for that?
Yes, so I used the white papers and from the National Archives that Phil Myers Miller's that showed the UK government, the cabinet minutes that showed the UK government's involvement and contact between the British government and the Indian government. I used those white papers and cabinet minutes.
Okay, and did you use anything in relation to the Indian government?
I didn't use any white papers, but I used speeches and different quotes and stuff that they said, which were in the journal articles and the research papers that I used.
Okay, I guess they mainly focused on Indira Gandhi then. Fair. Okay, last couple of questions then. Why and how do you think an understanding of 1984 through the lens of violence, oppression and resistance will be key in informing policy in respect to people of colour? And obviously, let's be honest, we're talking about Sikhs here, because I don't think any other group is really affected as much by the events of what takes place than us. How does you, or how will your research help to inform policy?
I think the three concepts, resistance, I think it's important to look at what resistance methods were employed and in what strategies, the protest and different civil disobedience and stuff, why that was employed and how that led to what happened in 1984. I think without understanding why they did the resistance movements and the oppression to begin with, you can't understand what happened because you're looking at it in isolation. But because I'm arguing and showing how it wasn't just an instantaneous event, you need to look at the decades beforehand. And to do that, I think you need to look at the violence, not just physical violence, but the mental violence that had been going and the psychological violence that had been going on from years before. And same with oppression. You need to look at the institutional oppression to show how they were able, one, to execute it and to get away with it. And then the resistance movement, I think the resistance is important because it's showing that the government used the narrative of terrorism so that they could securitize the issue, so that they could bypass a lot of power check. But if you actually look at what they're calling terrorism. It's actually just resistance strategies that are used by so many other communities who are struggling, who are going through struggles. But in this instance, it's not classed as resistance, it's classed as terrorism or like extremism. But in other instances, it's classed as resistance. So I think using these theories, you're able to change how people see the event and therefore the understanding.
No, couldn't disagree with anything you said. I think it makes perfect sense. To be quite honest, I've enjoyed the conversation quite a lot. I think you've brought a lot of depth from a very unique angle, because obviously, like, I'm quite historically minded, so I like dealing with like dates and facts and events and whatever. And I like the perspective of policy and looking it through the kind of the lens of violence, oppression, and resistance. And hats off to you, proverbially, obviously. I think you've done a tremendous job. Just then, the last question. How then does your dissertation and what you've outlined and kind of your overall theory relate to the events that are currently happening in India in relation to the farmers protest, but also in relation to the Indian government's handling of the COVID pandemic, obviously with this huge spike that's happening? I think there's a lot of parallels that could be made, but I'd just love to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I think it's actually quite like scary how many similarities there are when you look at both. I think with this, I think, again, how they've portrayed the farmers to the media and to to the citizens, it's been that they're in the wrong, they've thrown around like Khalistani terrorism so many times. And I think that's exactly what they try to do with Sanchi. I think the big difference between then and now is social media, the fact that they're not able to get away with it. When they try to do media blackouts like they did in 1984, then because of social media, it doesn't have the same impact. They're not able, and people are still able to show what's actually happening there. They're not able to hide what they could before. So I think that's a big difference. But like the fundamentals of what they're trying to do and what they're doing is similar.
No, fair. In relation to then kind of the handling of the pandemic, do you think there are parallels that you could make from that? Because obviously you could argue that there's state violence, oppression, and there's obviously resistance against that, because there are like loads of civilians, just normal people, trying to provide whatever needs to be provided for patients that obviously the government should be helping with. You could argue it's a form of violence on the populace as well, because obviously just ridiculous decisions such as like allowing 9 million people to gather, or however many millions of people it was at Kumbh, and then oppression to then obviously ban other events. So for argument's sake, I think it was Eid or something or whatever. Do you think there could be parallels made between the theory you've outlined and the Indian government's current handling of the pandemic?
I think you definitely could. I think with the idea of like cancelling Eid but not other events, I think that goes to, that just links with the like religious minority, the fact that they don't care about the religious minorities. And I think with the choosing which when to lift different restrictions and choosing what restrictions can, it's just this idea of they have the power and they have like this sovereign power that they don't have to and they don't feel like they have to listen to anyone else. They have ultimate say and they can just exercise it how they want to.
No, fair enough. Okay. I've gone through all of the questions that we had written down. I just want to double check before we wrap up if there's anything in particular you wanted to go over, or if there's anything that you wanted to include. I know we've gone through quite a lot quite quickly as well, so I just want to make sure that we've done it justice.
No, I think we've discussed quite a lot.
No, fair. Obviously, good luck with everything. I hope you get the marks you want. And to be honest, I hope you just get a first in everything, because work like this needs to be commended. And equally, good luck with everything post-graduation and everything that goes with that, because that is fun. And then obviously, just in relation to today, thank you for making the time. I'm just some random person who reached out to you on Twitter. So like, again, like, thank you for responding and actually making it happen so quickly. To everyone listening, thank you for listening to episode 13 of the Sorge Podcast.